Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Just Interesting podcast, the weekly show where we talk about things we find just interesting. And Robin, I am sick to death of not being absolutely filthy rich. And that is why I think that we should go treasure hunting. And I think maybe, just maybe, there might be some treasures out there that have yet to be discovered. And that, of course, is what we're going to be talking about today. But Robin, how have you been? How are you this week?
Oh, I'm well, thank you, Alex. Happy to be here. I'm very excited to be talking about lost treasures. This was one of those subjects where it's really hard to pick just a couple to talk about because there's so many that we could talk about.
I know, there's loads. And of course, I mean, I don't want to talk about all of them because, as many people will notice who are watching us currently on YouTube or listening to us at a later date, you will realize that we are down a member, Robin. Martin is not under house arrest. He is under house arrest, but he's broken his house arrest because he is currently searching for one of these lost treasures, but I won't say which one. Hopefully he finds it and hopefully he shares the wealth, but we shall see.
I was going to say, I'm more hopeful that he shares it with us because, hey, he could find it and do what he likes with it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll never know. Like, we'll meet up with him and be like, hey, did you find the treasure? He'll be like, no.
Whilst,
where'd the new Tesla come from? Found it.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Sure. Whatever.
Oh, is that a Rolex?
How'd you get back? Yeah. Is that your private jet parked in your back garden? You have a back garden? What? In central London? What? What's going on here?
Why are you just eating spoonfuls of caviar out of your backpack, Martin? What? Is that a Gucci handbag you're eating caviar out of? What?
Your wife looks different. Something different about her lips, cheekbones, chest area, and posterior. What is going on, Martin? What is going on?
Of course, yeah. But, no, I'm sure he'll be back with us very soon without treasure. Because, of course, people have been looking for these...
without treasure. You have so much faith in him, Alex. He'll be back with us without treasure.
Well, people have been looking for these for hundreds of years, Robin. And we're going to talk about some of those today. But before we get into that, I was wondering, would you like to hear a riddle?
Oh, I'd love to.
So here's one for you, Robin. Okay?
Oh.
30 white horses on a red hill. First they champ, then they stamp, then they stand still.
What?
I'll say it again. 30 white horses on a red hill. First they champ, then they stamp, then they stand still.
My word.
What's the answer?
I like the rhyme. Also, this sounds familiar. I may have heard this before, but I cannot think of the answer. Obviously, it's not actually horses, but 30 white horses. Where is a place that's red, like a hill, with 30 white things on it?
Well, have a think about that. Have a think about that, and I will tell you and the rest of our listeners the answer at the end of the episode. Before we jump into the main topic, though, Robin, I just wanted to say a massive thank you to everyone who is supporting us over on Patreon. Thank you all so, so much. You are the lifeblood of this channel and you're keeping the podcast going. So thank you, one and all. And I believe, Robin, you've got some special people that you want to mention.
Thank you, Alex, because I would particularly like to say thank you to James, still not bitten, Rashad Najjar, Caleb Wilkerson, Kurt Jones, John Baker, Janie, Henny Ruffle, The Super Show Podcast, Nicholas Dill, Emmett Tapia, Ahmad, Peaseward, Josh Tromatek, A Filthy Casual, Simon Workman, and Captain Wonky. Thank you all so, so much. You are wonderful people, all of you. And of course, thank you to everyone who's just listening to us. You don't have to support us, but if you do want to support us, you can get access to A Little More Interesting, which is a weekly extra little mini podcast that we do for our Patreon supporters and YouTube members, as well as some little behind the scenes sneak peeks at upcoming videos that we do. And of course, early access to our occasional, I was going to say one-off, but they're not one-off, they're occasional little mini documentaries that we do. So thank you all so much for supporting us all this time. You are wonderful.
Yes, thank you. And of course, if you didn't fancy supporting us on Patreon, you could always leave a review on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us to. They are always appreciated, and I think they help with the rankings or whatever. But I don't care about rankings anyway, so it's fine.
No, we gave up on the algorithm a long time ago.
So, Robin, did you have any favorite comments from the past week that you'd like to mention before we jump into the main topic?
I did. And actually, I'm taking this opportunity to go back a little bit further than usual, because there were some comments on previous episodes from a couple of weeks ago that I didn't respond to in our last episode. So I'd like to respond to those now.
Okay.
And there's a comment from Kimberly Bridges 8591 on our podcast episode about scary facts you never knew about sleep. They said, in response to, I think, I'm not quite sure how this came up, but there was a question raised at one point about what's your favorite detective show, crime solving amateur sleuth show.
Yeah, but they can't be law enforcement.
Yeah. And Kimberly Bridges says, we like Miss Fisher's murder mysteries.
Oh, okay.
I also love Brokenwood mysteries, but that is police. So they discounted Brokenwood. Miss Fisher's murder mysteries are good. I like those. It's an Australian show set in the 20s, I think, or maybe the 30s. And I'd forgotten all about it until this comment. So thank you for reminding me of it. It's good. It's got a very jazzy theme tune too.
What's Miss Fisher's profession?
I think she's a society girl.
Oh, like high society.
Yeah, she's a well-off widow, I want to say. Although she's called Miss Fisher, so maybe she isn't a widow. It's been a while since I've seen it. Yeah, she goes around high society solving crimes.
God, that sounds great. That sounds like a great show.
And she looks fabulous while she does it.
Nice.
Flapper girl style. You know.
I like it. Thanks. That's going on the suggestion list. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Recommend it. What about you? Any comments?
There was one comment I really liked from last week's episode, which was history's biggest military blunders. And this comes from Case Closed 9342. And of course, in military blunders, you spoke about Custer and his last stand.
I did.
And Case Closed 9342 says, in my mum's hometown, when she was growing up, there was a man whose last name was Custer, no relation to the historical figure, who ran an ice cream stand named Custer's Last Stand, which is great.
That's so good.
That's really good.
That's really good.
Would it have worked as well if it was Custer's Ice Stand, though? I don't know. There's something there, though. There's some like extra bit of joke that you could squeeze out of that.
You could milk out of that.
Milk is similar to cream.
Yeah,
ice cream.
No, it's a stretch. if it weren't an ice cream stand, but it served, you know, other desserts with custard.
Custard.
That would be the next level. Custard's Last Stand. That would be the next level, I think.
Yeah, but his name is Custer.
His name's Custer, so yeah, he's got to stick with that. Yeah, it's one of those. He's trapped. He's blessed and cursed by that name.
Yeah, yeah. If you can think of a better pun for an ice cream stand based on Custer's Last Stand, then feel free to let us know in the comments down below on YouTube, or you can message us over on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter. At Just Alex. Oh, I'm at Just Alexing.
At All Time Robin.
Or you can message us directly at JInterestingYT. Now, Robin.
Please do.
Would you care to jump into some lost treasures from history?
Oh, I would indeed.
Okay. So, shall I jump into one?
Please do, yeah.
Now, when we think of treasure, let's go to, the ones that we think of. The X marks the spot. It's got to be a bit of pirate treasure to start off with.
Yeah, pirates. Arr.
And who's the king of the pirates? Who's the legend himself? It's got to be Blackbeard. And Blackbeard is very well known for having some lost treasure.
And Edward Teach.
Edward Teach, exactly. And he's quoted as saying that only the location of his treasure is known only to himself and the devil. So,
whoa.
You know, it's out there somewhere.
That's a very badass thing to say.
Unless the devil stole it, of course, but who knows. So from 1716 to 1718, one of history's most famous pirates, Edward Teach, prowled the West Indies and the Atlantic coast of North America with his 40-gun flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge. He preyed on ships heading back to Spain, laden with gold, silver, and other treasures from Mexico and South America. In late 1718, a British naval force led by Lieutenant Robert Maynard succeeded in killing Blackbeard after a hard-fought battle. But before his death, Blackbeard claimed to have hidden a vast amount of treasure, but never told anyone its location. And it remains lost to this day, sadly. But the question is, will anyone ever find it, Robin?
So there's two conflicting emotions here. The first is that it's been so long, if they haven't found it already, they'll never find it. But we know that exploration technology in the recent years, the past decade or two, has really enhanced what archaeologists can do without actually having to dig anywhere. Like they've got those aerial laser scans of the jungle in Malaysia or somewhere, and they found lost cities by scanning, penetrating through the trees without having to actually go into the jungle and get lost and die of some kind of exotic disease or be mauled by a local fisherman. That wasn't how the sentence was meant to end, but that's how it ended. So, and in terms of deep sea exploration as well, we've got these deep sea sonar and similar kind of scanning things you can do on the seabed. So I don't know, in a way, I'm kind of more optimistic now that with the power of technology, they can perhaps explore more of the world more efficiently than ever before. And maybe with the right gear, the right funding, and the right determination, somebody could find it. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, like just look at the technology that we have these days with drones. Imagine Howard Carter with a drone. Oh, we'd have found more. I think you could be spot on, Robin. And I think the evidence for that fact is his ship was actually found in recent years, wasn't it? The Queen Anne's Revenge.
It was, yeah.
And I don't think it's been fully excavated yet. So maybe it could be down there, but
at least that's what they're telling us.
But contrary to popular belief, Robin, pirates didn't really leave maps that pointed to where they buried their treasure, which is sad. It's a shame.
You're telling me it's a product of fictional stories like Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island?
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of making me say that, but yeah. However, there are several likely locations where Blackbeard might have stored his loot. It's likely the treasure ended up in North Carolina. This was where the pirate ran his ship aground. And while it was confirmed to recently be discovered off the coast of North Carolina, it hasn't yet been fully excavated. Another popular site that people suggest could be Plum Point. And this is where Edward Teach had hoped to settle down after his life of piracy, which obviously never came to fruition. But it's possible he buried the treasure here, although there have been countless excavations of the site with little success. And aside from these locations, sadly, I mean, the treasure could be buried pretty much anywhere in the Caribbean if it existed at all. And that, to me, is a sad but also interesting point to raise, because Blackbeard's probably, I would say, the most famous pirate of all time. Aside, maybe Captain Morgan's taken it now
the rum. Yeah.
So you would assume that he was one of, if not the most successful pirates of all time. But according to his ledger, this isn't actually true. In today's money, he was actually only worth around $12.5 million, which is far less than Samuel. I wouldn't sniff at that. And if Martin finds
it, including the value of the ship in that, just out of curiosity.
No, probably not.
Okay.
No, yeah. I doubt that. But I mean, that was worth far less than Samuel Bellamy, which is around $120 million. And a handful of other pirates are beating him in terms of money as well. So he had a good marketing game. That was Blackbeard's real success.
Well, maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe he was his reputation was so fierce that prevented his own success. You know, people are after him because they think he's so successful. Mm. Whereas the others kind of keep it a bit quieter and like, I'm just going to quietly become like the Steve Jobs of the pirate world.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that there is actually some treasure still buried out there, or do you think it's this is all just a myth?
Specifically Blackbeard?
Oh yeah, specifically Blackbeard. But you can specifically Blackbeard, but also do you think that there is any pirate treasure out there still?
Oh, 100% I think there's pirate treasure, because I think they found some, haven't they? There have been a couple of instances of hoards, you know, buried hoards that probably were put there by pirates have been discovered, which would suggest the myth of buried pirate treasure is true.
Imagine finding a chest full of pirate treasure, like actually finding a chest full of pirate treasure. Yeah. I think that would be the coolest, like, wow, that's something ticked off the bucket list, isn't it? Like hauling up a massive pirate treasure. How many people can say that they've done that? Really, like, amazing.
You're completely right. That would be such an achievement. You could definitely go into your later stages of life proud of what you'd achieved if you'd done that, especially if you got to keep a slice of it.
That'd be a great dinner party conversation, I think. You could one up anyone. Mm.
You could actually.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations on the promotion, Mike. But have you found some pirate treasure? No, don't think so.
That reminds me of a time I was actually at a party. So someone was having a flat warming, and they invited a bunch of people that they knew from all walks of life, and they were a very sociable person. They knew all kinds of people, and I was in a conversation with a couple of other people, and one of them was very boastful about their achievements, and they were some kind of, I think they're in finance, typical, it was like very stereotypical, and they were quite arrogant about it. And the other person we were with, who I didn't know, was just very quiet and had a kind of slightly studious look to them. And the conversation turned, this finance person who's been very arrogant and talking about how much money they made, you know, turned to me and asked me what I did. And I told them what I did. And they were kind of like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. And then we turned to this third person and he was like, and what do you do? And they literally said, I'm a rocket scientist. Like, no, you're joking. They're like, no, I work for this military arms company and I make rockets. It's like, okay, that's actually the coolest thing that's ever happened. Anyway, tell me more about treasure.
Well, I mean, that was pretty much it, I think, with the treasure on the treasure front.
Ooh, okay.
I do have another one that I can talk about, though, if you'd like to hear another. Let's hear from you, Robin, and then I can come back to me after.
Okay, I'll try. There is a hopefully this won't sound repetitive, because the treasure I'd like to talk about is jewels as well, similar to classic pirate treasure. But I'd like to talk about a specific jewel called the Three Brothers, or the Brethren, which is, we know what it looked like, and we know its kind of dimensions, because it was described in a fair amount of detail a couple of times throughout its history. And this was, I'll read verbatim the descriptions of it. The first is from 1519, so 500 years ago. The Three Brothers is a very fine and rich buckle, adorned in the middle with a very big pointed diamond, and around this are three fine square ballast stones called the Three Brothers, and three sizable fine pearls in between these. Under the buckle hangs a very large, fine pearl in the shape of a pear. And a description from 1553 says, it's a great pendant bought from Flanders, having three large ballasses set without fault, one large pointed diamond and four large pearls, whereof one hangs underneath. And then again from 1587, a fair flower of gold with three great ballasses in the middest, a great pointed diamond and three great pearls fixed with a fair pearl pendant called the Brethren.
Mm. Wow. And
so I'll tell you the story of, of the Brethren.
That's a fancy buckle, did you say?
It's a very fancy buckle, yeah.
Wow. Was that for like a belt buckle or a bag buckle? Or?
It's more like a brooch, really.
Right, okay.
Kind of thing you'd pin to your dress or suit, or in some cases a hat, actually. One of the people who wore it wore on their hat.
Mm, fair enough.
So it's this jewel was commissioned by Duke John the Fearless of Burgundy in 1389. And it's important to know that the dukes, although they were called dukes of Burgundy, were essentially kings, that they were so powerful and rich that they were effectively kings of Burgundy, but they were called dukes. It was commissioned by to be created by a Parisian goldsmith called Herman Roussel in 1389. And we know this because we've still got the receipt and the bill for it, dated to the 11th and 24th of November in 1389.
Yeah, you don't want to lose that receipt. That's
you don't.
If it ever shows up, I'm going to return it. Get a full refund.
The Dukes of Burgundy had it, passed it father to son until the first half of the 15th century, and then it got one of the Dukes of Burgundy took it into battle, and he got defeated, and the victors took it, kept it in a town called Basel in Germany, until 1504, when a man called Jakob Fugger bought it, and he negotiated for it for a whole year. And the reason I mentioned Jakob Fugger is because he was the richest man in world history.
Oh, yeah?
And yeah.
How rich? How rich are we talking?
How rich? Do you want to know? Okay. So at the time of his death, his wealth was worth the equivalent of $400 billion in today's money.
Wow, okay.
Which, yeah, about 2% of Europe's GDP at the time. So he bought the jewel after a year of negotiations and he planned to sell it for a profit to the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian I, the most powerful man in Europe. But even the emperor was like, that's too expensive, and refused to buy it. He did buy every other jewel that Fugger had, but it goes to show just how expensive this jewel was to buy.
Fair enough, yeah.
We also know from a letter in 1554 that Henry VIII really wanted it and was in negotiations to buy it, but died before the sale actually was completed. And the sale was completed in 1551 by his son, Edward, who was King of England. So this is how expensive this thing was, how valuable it was. They negotiated to buy it for about 7 years.
Wow.
The Kings of England.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do we know how much they paid for it? Or is there a...
We do. We do. So for starters, just for context, between 1529 and 1532, so a three-year period, Henry VIII spent the equivalent of £7 million on jewellery. And yet... this jewel was too expensive for him to buy. And eventually, Edward VI, who was only 14 years old, and actually in his diary, he complains that he was forced to buy it for the equivalent of £7 million.
Wow.
In 2023 money. So essentially, he spent on one jewel the same amount that his father spent on jewels in this big spending spree he had. Yeah. And apparently in his diary, he complains that he was forced to buy it because they owed the Fugger family a lot of money, about £23 million. So they were like, you owe us money, we'll sell you this jewel you'll buy this jewel off us and pay off the debt.
I mean, that doesn't feel like that. I don't know, if it's the equivalent of 7 million today and it's the monarchy, is that like, surely at this point, that's just kind of pocket change for them. that's a very expensive jewel. Like, even they recognize, wow, that's a lot for one pendant or one brooch.
Well, exactly. Like I said, Henry VIII spent the same amount on 3 years worth of jewelry from all over the place, and this one item cost £7 million. I think also, I've always been a bit displeased with straightforward inflation calculators because I do think, say, a pound, it was £25,000 that he spent in 1551 on the jewel, which is calculated to be inflated to £7 million today. But I think £1 in 1551 would still get you a lot further. You know, say it was... a month's wages was £1.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
It doesn't quite calculate the value of it. Like, it's inflation. Yeah. The inflation doesn't quite calculate the.
No, I don't think it does quite capture how valuable, how much money people spent on it. So naturally, this valuable jewel became part of the crown jewels of England, and it was worn by Elizabeth I. She quite liked it. In fact, there are at least two portraits in which she's wearing it, so we know exactly what it looked like. And when they put up a marble monument to her in Westminster Abbey upon her death, they even carved, they put a replica of the three brothers on her tomb because she liked it so much. And in 1606, when James I came to the throne of England and he inherited the crown jewels, the three brothers were listed in an inventory of the monarch's possessions, and they were noted as jewels never to be alienated from the crown.
Well, I bet that's not where the story goes.
Not at all. Sadly, James I's son, Charles I, was plagued by financial problems throughout his reign. And as you know, he had a very testy relationship with Parliament, let's say that. Yeah. Didn't result in the civil wars at all, no. Sadly, because of his financial troubles, the monarchy faced bankruptcy in the 1640s. And Charles I sent his wife, Henrietta, to Europe to see if she could sell any of the crown jewels. And of course, she aimed to sell the three brothers in particular because it was so valuable. But nobody would buy it. We have a letter from her to Charles I saying, "I tried and failed to sell your jewels. No one's willing to pay the price. It's too valuable to sell."
Henry VIII and his son got absolutely mugged off, I think.
I think they did.
Yeah.
And we know that by the end of 1645, she's returned. So other people are reporting to Parliament and saying the three brothers haven't been sold. So we know from her private letter to Charles I and from a report to Parliament that the three brothers' jewels are part of the crown jewels in 1645. But after that point, we just don't know. They disappear from history. They're not here today. They seem to have just disappeared. No records exist. The problem is that we get in 1649, the end of the Civil Wars.
Yeah.
Charles I's execution. And anything could have happened in that period.
Very true. Very
true. To the three brothers. And it's frustrating because the jewels themselves, from the descriptions, what's unusual is that they're very similar in size, these three ballasts, and they're almost identical in shape and size. And from the description of the jeweler who created them, it seems like they weren't cut down to size. They were pretty much found that way and just neatened up into this. Yes, yeah, incredibly unusual, incredibly rare, and incredibly valuable.
I'm looking at pictures of it now, and it is very unique, isn't it? As an item, it would stand out.
It really is, and
interesting.
No one has knowingly come across any of the jewels that, when, like you say, we've got pictures of it, so we know what it looked like. No one has knowingly come across the jewels since then, so we don't know if they were broken apart and kind of sold separately, given away, ransomed, traded, whatever, because no one seems to have come across them individually. And we certainly haven't got them together, complete, as part of the crown jewels.
Do you reckon it was... And it was around English Civil War time that they went missing.
Yeah.
So do you think Cromwell sold it? Do you think he had any part of it? How long was it that there was no monarchy? It's like... 10 years or something.
10 years, yeah.
So is there just a period, that period where like they just messed with the books a little bit and I don't know, sold some things? Yeah, and
it's possible. I mean, I think most historians who have a theory would suggest that probably Henrietta, Charles I's wife, managed to sneak it away in exchange for some money at some point. But that's only because the royal family were the ones with the most direct access to it.
Yeah.
But you're right. Why couldn't any of the parliamentarians have just literally taken the jewels from them. It's easy to hold in your hand, as you've seen the pictures. It's used as a buckle. It's used as a kind of brooch on people's dresses. Elizabeth I wore it as a kind of like a pendant. And then Charles I wore it in his hat as a kind of hat badge. So it was small enough that anyone could easily steal it.
Also, I mean, it's made up of gems that are quite individual. Like, I imagine you could easily split it up as well and sell them separately and still make quite a lot of money. Maybe it's just found its, like, destroyed and found its way onto the market in different ways.
Yeah, and it's a real shame because from 1389 to 1645, which is a long time in history, we know from the descriptions of it that it was virtually unchanged. It was so remarkable that normally when people, kind of like if you get, a house. If you buy a house, you'll redecorate it. Normally, in this period, when super wealthy people got jewelry, they would often reset the jewels or have them cut down into a new shape. Like the crown, the British crown itself is made up of lots of other jewels acquired. I'm going to say that word from foreign countries and foreign rulers, and removed from the whatever jewel or crown or sword or whatever object it was embedded in. From a foreign country and then put into the crown, the British crown. It's quite common for royal families in particular, but any wealthy people, to buy a jewel and then give it to a jeweler and say, reshape this into something new.
Yeah.
But the three brothers was so special and so remarkable that for over 200 years, people didn't touch it and kept it as it was until it went missing. So it's out there somewhere.
Well, best of luck, Martin. Give us the good news.
One for each of us, right? It's the three brothers.
Yeah. okay. Well, I've got another treasure for you, Robin.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
This one's a little bit unusual because it's not a treasure as we would think of it normally. It's not jewelry. It's not pirate treasure, but it's rather a sword.
Oh.
And this is the Honjo Masamune sword that I want to talk about.
Oh, cool.
And this one...
I've never heard of this.
So, I'm going to massively mispronounce this name, apologies. Goro Nayudu Masamune was a Japanese swordsmith who lived in the 13th century and is widely regarded as the greatest sword maker in Japanese history. He's a famous guy. Famous guy. At the age of 23, he had already been made the chief swordsmith for the Emperor Fushimi, and he made numerous swords and daggers, all with exceptional quality and with a recognizable style, and that's important. His blades had a unique wave-like effect that came from tempering the steel at different temperatures. This practice made the blade stronger and was decades ahead of its time. And the most famous weapon he ever created was probably the Honjo Masamune sword. This blade represented the Tokugawa shogunate and was passed down from one shogun to the next for over 200 years. It was considered one of the finest swords ever forged and was made a national treasure of Japan in 1939. So we had it. We had it available in 1939. They knew where it was. And then the funniest thing happened. Can you guess what happened next? In 1939. Towards the end of the Second World War, the blade was lost to history and has never been seen since.
No.
Yeah, and this was a hugely historically significant item. It's a national treasure of Japan. It's mad. It was carried for over 200 years, passed down from one shogun to the next. This is... like a real historic item.
It's like a real Excalibur.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, that's a great comparison. So the only information that we have is that towards the end of the war, during the Allied occupation of Japan, the production of blades with an edge was forbidden. And anyone who owned one of these swords were ordered to turn them in. The last owner of the Honjo Masamune sword was Tokugawa Iemasa, who reportedly handed the blade into police to encourage other families to comply to do the same. So this was during the Allied occupation. So this was handed in to Allied forces. by this last owner as a kind of symbolic gesture, I guess, to encourage other people. Look, we're giving up this national treasure of Japan. You know, you can give up your sword and knives and cutlery or whatever. Just if we're giving up this item, you can give up yours. And I think that's what's saddest about this whole thing. You know, like it was voluntarily given up. And from this point on, there's very little record of where it went. Apparently, the police handed it to an American officer called Sergeant Coldy Bymore. However, there's no record that this man exists, and it was thought that he was misidentified. Whenever they handed it over, maybe they got the name wrong. Maybe there was a language barrier. Coldy Bymore. Mm. That doesn't sound like a real name. Either the sword is now owned by the US government, or Japanese authorities lied about the real one and kept it hidden, or it's sitting in a mantelpiece in some American, descended from like an American GI, and is sitting on someone's mantelpiece right now, probably in the US. And also probably unbeknownst to them as well, at the true value of this item. If it is, it could just be sitting somewhere and someone's like, oh yeah, that's the sword that grandpa got from Japan. And they don't even know how valuable it is, you know.
In someone's garage,
just
collecting dust.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a disturbing thought.
But I mean, this one is recent enough that I do hope that it's found at some point, you know. It's also, unlike a jewel, it's a sword, right? You can melt it down, but you're just going to get metal from it. It's not like, a jewel, pendant, you can break all the jewels out and redistribute it and make something new.
Yeah.
This feels, I don't think anyone would just destroy it for no reason.
And I do think since, perhaps because of the exposure to Japanese culture as a result of World War II, even now in 2023, but since I think the Second World War, there's been an appreciation for samurai swords in the West. That means even if people didn't realize what exactly they had in terms of how valuable this sword is, they probably wouldn't destroy it. They probably would take it to antiques dealers or pawn shops or something and say, what can you give me for this?
Sure, yeah.
The dealer would absolutely sell it on and they wouldn't destroy it. I think it's definitely the kind of, it's not like the jewelry where if you've got jewelry, you go like, it's just gold and shiny gems. I'd definitely melt this down, break it apart and destroy this otherwise priceless object. With a sword, you're probably going to keep it, I think. Particularly a samurai sword.
I'm kind of hopeful that maybe one day it will be rediscovered. But not right now, unfortunately.
Under the right circumstances, somebody needs to find it underneath that big pile of rubbish in their granddad's attic, and then they need to take it to the right appraiser who will be like, wait a second, this isn't any old sword.
Have you inherited a sword from unknown origins? Get in touch today.
You never know, maybe it'll work. Maybe we should do that. That's a good one, and that's a great example of not all treasure is gold.
Exactly. Mm. All that glitters is not gold. Does that apply in this instance? Is that saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it works.
So come on then, Robin, take us home. Have you got another one for us?
I'm going to do a full 180 and back to gold. Because I would like to talk about Fabergé eggs. Have you ever heard of them?
I have heard of Fabergé eggs, yes.
Yeah, I think everyone knows what a Fabergé egg is. Yeah.
From Russia, right? Russia?
Indeed. Yeah. Exactly. The House of Fabergé in Russia. Don't be misled by the very French name. It is actually from Russia. And I actually didn't realize, obviously I've always been fascinated by Fabergé eggs and always known what one looks like. These iconic, beautiful, large eggs, bejeweled and enameled, and all kinds of fine artistry going on. You know, one of them is kind of got etched snowflakes in its surface. Another one is they've all contained surprises and they all open up in some way to reveal something. And sometimes it's an incredibly ornate miniature, you know, 1-inch fully detailed golden carriage. In other ones, it's scenes from the Bible, or sometimes some of them I think even contain flowers made of jewels, as in they look like, I think Rosebud is the famous one. It looks like a yellow rose, but it's actually a jewel. It's absolutely astonishing. But I didn't realize they were all from a very particular period in history. So they're all made by the by Peter Carl Fabergé between 1885 and 1917. They were all, he was the designer, he had a craft workshop, and he oversaw the construction of them or did them himself. And pretty much all of them, and we know that there were 69, in total, were were created for the Russian emperors. He made 52 imperial eggs. For the Russian emperors Alexander III and Nicholas II, which were Easter presents for their wives and their mothers.
Oh, yeah, of course.
In fact, most of them were made in a short period under Nicholas II, Tsar Nicholas II, who was making two a year, or commissioning two a year of his reign, one for his mother and one for his wife.
Would you prefer, if you got a Fabergé egg as an Easter gift, would you prefer that or a chocolate egg?
Chocolate egg every time.
Yeah. Oh, see, that's the wrong answer. You get the Fabergé egg, you sell it, you buy more chocolate.
Yeah, I know.
Think outside the box, Robin.
I'd rather have the immediate gratification than the effort of selling a gift. Come on, man.
Sorry to derail you with that.
No, that's fine. It's a good question. it kind of is. So of the 52 imperial eggs, only 46 of them are known to still be out there. Their whereabouts are known, I should say.
So they're out
so
there.
Where are the missing six? Now, just so you know how valuable these things are, there haven't always been just six missing. Over the years, there have been many missing, and you can understand why they were missing, because something happened in 1917 in Russia to the royal family in particular that meant all of a sudden all these 52 imperial eggs just disappeared overnight. It was the Russian Revolution. And of course, in 1918, the Romanov family were murdered, and goodness knows what happened to all their possessions. However, Maria Fyodorovna, who was the mother of Tsar Nicholas II and the wife of Tsar Alexander III, who owned, because she was the recipient of a bunch of these Fabergé eggs, she survived. She didn't get killed in the Russian Revolution. And oddly enough, the six missing imperial eggs all belonged to her.
Ooh, okay. So, interesting.
Theories abound as to what exactly happened to them, but there's definitely a connection. What happened to her? What did she do with them? Did she sell them to support her exiled lifestyle? Did she secrete them?
Exiled.
Did she hide them just to protect them from the Bolsheviks as the memory of her murdered family? Or did she get careless and lose them in the panicked flight from the Bolsheviks? Who knows? Some of them have been recovered. So there used to be more than six missing. And just so our audience is aware, but they're basically priceless. You can't put a price on a Fabergé egg. Each one is going to fetch an unpredictable amount of money. But 11 of them have been sold at auction for a known value. Others have been so expensive that the value has been kept secret. And of the ones that we know the value of their sales, the cheapest was the Rosebud that I mentioned earlier, which is one of the finest ones, as it happens. And that was sold for $4 million.
Okay.
The last one to be sold was known as the Third Imperial Easter Egg, and this one was the last one to be sold because it was the last one to be found. It was missing until quite recently, and when that was put on the market or up for auction, it sold for $33 million.
Well, there's only so, we know, the thing is, I guess we know how many there are. So, like, the more they get found, they're just going to get more and more valuable. Fabergé yeah, eggs were exactly. the original NFTs. They were the they were the crypto actually, of their time.
yeah, you're kind of right, actually. And I hadn't thought about that, but that's not a bad comparison. So yeah, if you're lucky enough to discover a Fabergé egg, you're guaranteed to fetch not only millions of dollars, but probably more than the last one. They more or less, each time they've sold one, it's fetched more money because, as you say, there's a finite amount. And yeah, a bit like Bitcoin, there's a finite number and people are mad for them. So there are 6 Fabergé eggs out there. All of them belonged to Maria Fyodorovna, who was the mother of Tsar Nicholas II. And there'll never be any more Fabergé eggs because they were all made by this one man or by his craftspeople. And after the Russian Revolution, he fled Russia and retired and died. And the craft and the skills are more or less lost. There are fakes out there. There have been numerous fakes, but apparently they're quite easy to spot because nobody can imitate a true Fabergé.
They are. They're beautiful, still, aren't they? They are amazing craftsmanship, the ones I'm looking at.
They really are. They're definitely... I'm not a big fan of kind of gaudy things as decorations, but yeah. I would absolutely happily have a Fabergé egg on my mantelpiece. How cultured.
Yeah, you'd need a whole team of private security to keep it there, I think. But
I think I would, yes. It'd have to be a very large and stable mantelpiece as well.
Yeah.
That thing's not getting knocked off.
Oh my God, yeah. That would be the worst. You just drop it and smash it.
A friend brings their dog round and it just leaps up and knocks over.
Oh gosh.
Oh dear.
So there are 6 out there still to get.
Yeah.
Got to catch them all.
Got to catch them all. So yeah, I want to know, Alex, how much would you be willing to spend in pursuit of one of these eggs if you thought you had it? You could find one.
I'll give you 50 quid for one right now. Have you got one in your pocket?
No, I don't.
Damn. Like if I was Jeff Bezos, if I was Elon Musk, I would actually, you know what is bad? Because I would actually be tempted to buy one. I have no real interest in that, you know, period of history. Well, no, that sounds harsh. I like history and I like that, you know, but I don't have a real interest in them. But it's the fact that, there's only a finite amount of them. If I don't buy it, then there's never going to be another, there might never be another chance to get one. And what a centerpiece to have one. So if I was like a billionaire, maybe I'd buy one. I wouldn't pay more than a billion for it.
Man, you set a precedent, wouldn't you? If you were a multi-billionaire and you've spent $1 billion on a Fabergé egg and there's still 5 to go, the next 5 people would be like, oh, damn you, Alex. damn you, Elon.
But you know what? Thinking about it, I probably wouldn't. I'd be tempted, but I wouldn't buy one.
You wouldn't. Yeah.
If I did buy one, I'd make sure it ended up somewhere that people could actually see it and appreciate it. You know?
Yeah.
It belongs in a museum.
I agree. Yeah. So do you? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, so that's my other treasure.
How about you, Robin? What would you spend on a Fabergé egg?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I think if I could anticipate selling it for over $30 million, I'd be willing to spend, say, $20 million on an expedition to find one, if I had that money.
Okay.
Take out a loan.
Yeah.
Go to the bank. I would like $15 million loan, please, with an option to extend to another $5 million.
Just on the off chance you find a Fabergé egg.
And
if you don't, you're screwed, but...
Hey, sure, we can give you that with an interest rate of 3,000%, and I say it's fine.
It's fine, because it's fine. I'm going to get a Fabergé egg.
And sell it for $1 billion to my friend Alex.
yeah. Okay.
I'm like you. I genuinely, it's the one thing that I never get how people can justify spending hundreds of millions of dollars or even millions of dollars on a single object. But Fabergé egg, something about it, I'm just like, you know what? I would like that.
The three brothers pendant. Nah, not interested. That's why they couldn't sell it. Because it's like,
well, yeah.
What does it do?
No one was interested.
Does it open up? Is there a chariot inside of it? No, not interested then. Whereas Fabergé eggs, yeah. I can see why they took off. That's, yeah.
Mm. I mean, they did also contribute to a revolution that completely changed the course, the destiny of an entire nation of hundreds of millions of people. That's how important they are, folks. That's how important they are.
Well, yeah.
The opulence of the Romanovs encapsulated in a Fabergé egg.
Mm, yeah.
Imagine if one of the lost Fabergé eggs, and there's no reason, there's absolutely no reason to think this is true. I'm just like speculating here. Imagine if you found a Fabergé egg, one of the missing ones, and it's buried deep, deep, deep under, say, the river in St. Petersburg, and you find it clasped in the hands of Rasputin's corpse.
Whoa.
Whoa. And inside is like Rasputin's devil-worshipping pendant with which you bewitched the Romanovs. And suddenly, not only do you have a Fabergé egg, but you've got Rasputin's corpse and the means by which to rule the world by controlling world leaders' minds.
Do you know what I think, Robin, if that happened to me?
Yeah.
I think,
yeah.
God, who's going to play me in the movie of all of this? Who do I want? Who's going to play me? I can pay for whoever I want now.
That's true. Oh, dear.
Who do you reckon? Who do you reckon could pull off my style?
Oh, that's a good one.
This could get very offensive very quickly, couldn't it?
So just to explain my train of
maybe
thought.
Maybe James Corden?
Oh, gosh, no. Just to explain my train of thought. So I always think, Alex, you could make a great Nathan Drake. And as we know, Tom Holland played Nathan Drake.
That's absurd.
In Uncharted. So I think Tom Holland would be a good choice.
Give him a beard. Yeah. But do you think Tom Holland... Okay, we're going off topic now, but... Did Tom Holland really fit Nathan Drake as a character? I don't know.
I mean, not really.
Nah.
Not really. Yeah, it was a different type. How about Mark Wahlberg?
Please don't give me Mark Wahlberg.
I struggle, Alex. No one can quite capture your good-looking kindness. All these good-looking alpha males in Hollywood, they're too aggressive.
Aww.
Yeah, they're too...
Yeah. Yeah. Chris Pratt could play you though, Robin.
Thanks. Thanks?
No, I'm joking. I don't know.
It's all right. You don't have to. You can be as insulting as you like, because it's probably true.
I mean, I don't think that's not really an insult, is it?
No,
but I don't know. I don't know who would play us in the story of we find a Fabergé egg clutched in the hands of Rasputin's corpse.
If we could resurrect any actor, which possibly we could with Rasputin's devil worshipping pendant, maybe, Alex, the only person who could play you would be in his prime era. You know, I'm talking 1940s, Orson Welles.
Oh my gosh. Okay, yeah, maybe in that instance.
Now I think about it, there kind of is a resemblance.
French champagne.
Oh, the Fabergé egg has been celebrated for its opulence.
Tis a Romanov egg. Oh, wow. Okay.
Does it do anything?
I think on that note, let's bring this story to a close. So Robin, good. Would you be interested in hearing what the answer to the riddle was?
Yes, I really would. Could you repeat it just to give me one more chance?
So the riddle was 30 white horses on a red hill. First they champ, then they stamp, then they stand still.
Yeah, 30 white horses. Oh, wait a second. Is it teeth?
It is teeth. Well done.
Yes.
Well,
I think something about the way you said champ just then.
It's
I was
champ.
Like, wait a second.
It's too
champ.
Close to chomp.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. I was really struggling, but then you gave it to me. Thank you. Whew. Ah, I feel not so stupid.
I didn't give it to you.
Like
I just
one.
Read the riddle. It's absolutely fine.
Well, you're very kind of the way you read it. At first, my first thought was how many people on a cricket team? And then I was like, when do they stamp and champ? What's that all about?
Yeah, and then they stand very still, do they?
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense. And then, yeah. Well, I thought there were 32 teeth in the average human mouth.
Yeah, but it varies, doesn't it? It's like, depending on how many wisdom teeth are. 30's about, about there, thereabouts.
Okay.
Yeah.
I never counted mine. Yeah, so.
Well, now you've got some fun weekend plans, Robin.
Could be lying in bed with my tongue, kind of like, I'm counting my teeth. How many are there? Yeah.
Exactly.
My gosh. Well, thank you. That was a good riddle.
You're welcome, Robin. And if you ever do finish counting your teeth, then why don't you get out there and go and find some of history's lost treasure? And why don't you at home give it a go yourself and let us know if there's any other treasures that we missed from this discussion that you'd like to see us talk about in future episodes. And as always, thank you so much for listening to us. Thank you for supporting us if you do on our Patreon channel. And yeah, we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.